The following segment of The Velvet Sledgehammer presents tapes edited and selected from the first East Coast Conference on Women and Pornography.
My name is Gloria Steinem, and I've written down 2 minutes worth because I find that talking is spread out and writing is more concise, or can be more concise. It's the late 40s. Some of the football players in my Toledo high school passed pornographic versions of Popeye comic books around under their desks, making sure that all of us, the girls, glimpsed the drawings of women being beaten and being eviscerated by Popeye's enormous penis. And the women love it, of course, and they beg for it. The same boys beat up the few black players on opposing teams after football games, Negro players, we would have said then. The same boys were occasionally rumored to lock some uppity, quote, fast girl. There were also only 2 kinds of girls in Toledo, Ohio, good girls and bad girls, to lock some fast girl up in a garage for the weekend and gangbang her and sell tickets to neighborhood men. One such girl left town, one became a prostitute, proving, of course, that she and all of the others loved it. The rest of us made very sure never to be fast and never, never to be uppity. In the 1950s, it was Playboy, a brand new cult, less violent but still full of dominance and conquering than the illegal pornography, the first pornographic magazine respectable enough for a man to be seen buying. It was a very, very successful formula. I get in an argument that I still remember with Jules Pfeiffer in a semi-public place about why he is making the magazine more respectable by publishing there. And I am surprised and very embarrassed to find tears of rage at the back of my throat, so I have a very hard time speaking. Jules says that Hefner is a very talented editor and very good for his work, and he wins the argument hands down. Everyone around us laughs and calls me uptight. It is 1962. There is the first Playboy Club in New York, and I get an angry, Nellie Bly kind of idea that I will become a waitress, or what they call a bunny, or if the woman is a black woman, a chocolate bunny, and do a journalistic expose of the experience. I do. It is far worse than I thought. It is like being on a meat hook, I go home and write. And the money isn't even good. I am asked to testify in court against the Playboy Club, whose executives have admitted bribing the state liquor authority in order to get a liquor license. The Playboy lawyer, Milton Pollack, attempts, very successfully, to humiliate me sexually on the witness stand. I am also named in a $1 million libel suit for allegedly implying that the Playboy Club has mafia connections. Actually, I did not do that thing. I thought the guys with the black shirts and the Italian names were just kidding. It doesn't matter. Playboy wins their liquor license, and the libel case evaporates somehow. Pollack, the humiliating, strident Playboy lawyer, is appointed to the federal bench. A decade later, it is he who sentences Jane Alpert to prison. It's 1970. Feminism has given me confidence to take women's rage seriously and even to take my own rage seriously. I decide to interview Hefner, hoping he will hang himself with his own words, which of course he does. He insists that he does not know why feminists are angry with him, that we should in fact be grateful to him, that he knows what women want, that he has set women free. I go home and write that a woman reading Playboy feels like a Jew reading a Nazi manual. I still don't understand, however, that pornography is violence, not sex, and that sex need not be violent or aggressive at all. I don't understand that until women begin to speak out about rape, and that makes the parallel and it makes the separation very clear. Thanks. Thank you, all of you who spoke out. My education about pornography is speeded up somewhat by becoming a subject of it. Screw publishes a poster-sized new drawing with great labial detail. Down the side of this poster are an assortment of penises that you are to cut out in order to play a game, which is the banner across the poster, which says, quote, pin the cock on the feminist, unquote. It is hung from the newsstand outside the Ms. office. It seems, in my mind anyway, to be everywhere. I send a complaint to Al Goldstein, who some friends who are Village Voice writers assure me is really a nice guy. He sends me back a small box of candy with a note that says, eat it. More and different nude calendars continue to appear. I feel bad. I feel lousy. I feel exposed. I feel had. I fantasize revenge, endless scenarios of revenge. Finally, I talk to Bella Abzug, who has not seen this poster, and she breaks the spell by saying, as I am describing how this nude figure has my head and my face, she says, and it has my labia. I realize that Bella has broken the spell by putting herself with me in the situation of humiliation, and I realize how much laughter helps and how much exerting our own power through making a joke, through identifying with each other, through laughter, truly helps. I decide I have finally got out of the Toledo, Ohio nice girl syndrome enforced by fear. And like beautiful Bella, I have become an uppity woman. But I am still not prepared for the urge to kill in revenge that I feel in what I thought was my pacifist heart. While watching the male audience's laughter and cheers when I see a phony but very realistic version of a snuff movie. And I am still not prepared for the desire I feel to kill the father of the woman who spoke about being a victim of incest for so many years, and to kill the brother who abused the woman who stood here. And I am amazed always to find the depth of the hatred and the violence that is inside me. I'm still not prepared either for the right-wing banning of Ms. Magazine from school libraries or supermarkets because it is supposed to be pornographic. Because they point out that we write about sexuality, because they point out that we once printed a small painting by a woman which showed a nude man, because there are articles by and about lesbians, and because there is a classified section which advertises lesbian publications, and even because of a cover story that was about sexual harassment on the job, and even though it used puppets on the photograph, on the cover, it was still banned from supermarkets. There are more lawsuits, aided this time by ACLU, and fortunately without Judge Pollack. Clearly, it is independent, autonomous women and freely chosen sexuality that the right wing and many of the courts consider to be pornographic. In Bella's campaign, we begin to write position papers for the first time, political position papers on what can be done with city regulations about pornography. In 1978, we do an issue about the difference between pornography and erotica, with long articles plus a woman's speak out section. And we are picketed by the pornography industry of Times Square outside the office, who march outside our building with signs saying that Ms. is bad for our biz, and many more obscene posters. And the saddest thing is that the pickets are women. We began to understand the depth of this issue and the financial and the cultural and the patriarchal interest in it through the depth of the opposition to it. And we begin finally to understand that it is not sex that is pornographic. It is never nudity that is pornographic. It is violence and dominance that are pornographic. Pornography is the propaganda and the instruction. Rape is the practice. Sexual abuse of children is the practice. Battered women are the practice. Battered children are the practice. Pornography is the drug of violence with which a patriarchal society attempts to hook men, to make them behave dominantly, to continue the power structure as it stands. Untangling sex from violence will save lives, and it will save our sexuality. But we have to do it not only when it comes to pornography. We have to do it in life, because until we end this power structure in which there is an unequal distribution of ability to control our own lives, until males and females are individually equally autonomous and can choose, when a powerless group comes together with a powerful one, it will be a pornographic encounter in our lives. That's what the current dominant-passive pattern is, whether it is the heterosexual pattern among men and women, or whether it is that dominant-passive pattern which some men and men and women and women have been forced to imitate because there is no other. Until that ends, much of our own real life will be pornographic, not just what we see in the streets. Yesterday, while I was brushing my teeth, I heard this story on the radio. Perhaps you did too. It is about a man who has a nationwide pornography business specializing in child pornography. This man is a good symbol of the fact that it is not just the mafia and not just organized crime and not just big business. It is, in fact, our brothers and our fathers and the people who are next to us. This man was a second grade teacher. This man taught family living. This man has been teaching many children for many years and has a teenage daughter. His principal said of him that in 10 years in his school, he has always seemed very normal in his behavior, as a good dresser, neat and clean, and an admirable person. That is the enemy. Thank you.
My name is Lois Gould, and I'm a novelist, and I also do some journalism. And I guess I've been aware and interested in and horrified by the issue of pornography and the relationship between pornography, violence, dominance, and mostly contempt for women since the first time a boy ever called me by a four-letter word reducing me to the sum of my sexual parts. And what he said precisely was, in answer to my request to borrow a book of his that I had wanted to read, and his reply was, "We don't lend books to any gash." I was 12 when that occurred, and I don't think I'll ever forget how it sounded. I'd never heard the word. I wasn't aware of where it came from. And suddenly, I had awakened to something that I guess before that I had never thought of. One saw the word "fuck" on the walls of public buildings, and one recognized in some dim recess of one's mind that using the word as an epithet, which in the old days used to really be only a sexual word and subsequently became the use for any evil treatment or abusive treatment of one person by another. This is a very new and quite vicious and complete surrender to the idea of subjugation of women through words and images. The images, of course, are much more recent. We used to only have words. And about 4 years ago, I visited the first so-called adult store to open on Lexington Avenue in what they used to call dry dock country. And I wrote a little piece about my visit, and I'd like to read a little of it to you. We seem to be in a church. It is dark and silent. Solitary, huddled figures lost, seemingly in prayer, stand transfixed before small religious articles and books, or lined up with bowed heads along two rear walls, faces pressed against mysterious black boxes that emit flickering light but no sound. In the center stands a large elevated wood pulpit heaped with sacred coins in neat piles. Behind it, a man, priest-like, dispenses change. He is pale and solemn, expressionless, as befits his station. The gloom lightens and we see that it is an adults-only store, indeed a kind of church for the hardcore believer. Everybody inside is male. Only the religious articles pertain to the female. Inflatable plastic dolls, books, photographs, films, and what is ironically called love aids. Suddenly the voices of live women pierce the silence. A flicker of fear and loathing passes over the stone face of the manager on the platform. The male patrons whirl around in panic, folded raincoats clutched to their bodies like shields. Two women hover at the doorway. Marge. Millicent, look at the sign. Adults only. Women also welcome. Millicent. Oh, Marge, I've never been in an adult store. Want to try it? After all, the mayor of New York tried it. Marge. Well, you think it's safe? Millicent. It's got to be safer in there than out here on the street. I mean, in there, at least you know the person next to you is a pervert maniac. Is there a place to check our coats? Four men whirl around again, terrified, holding onto their raincoats for dear life. Mingled cries. Check our coats? They wouldn't dare. Nobody checks Rico's coat, understand? Nobody. The manager restores order. Raincoat men scurry back to their posts, clutching and hunching. Marge, browsing at the notions counter. Look at these little gadgets, Millicent. I hear Clovis got one after her divorce. How does she like it? Oh, you know Clovis. She's crazy about it, but she's afraid to make a lasting commitment. As they talk, more men move away from them, recoiling, so that soon there's a great clearing of empty space around them, as if they were Martians in a bleak alien landscape. For the most part, they remain oblivious to the ostracism and the hatred that swirls around them. Manager, ladies, perhaps you'd like to step back here and visit our foreign film section. What's playing? Everything's playing, lady. This week we got your basic torture and degradation, your flouting of deep-seated cultural and religious taboos, your little schoolboy crushes on rubber, leather, fur, and double-knit polyester, your cute but poorly trained animals, your depraved baby girls preying on unsuspecting middle management executives. Millicent, got any handsome young men with mature ladies? Marge, maybe a lady sultan with a male harem? Or how about a nice kissing scene with just Robert Redford? Manager, listen, what kind of place you think this is, lady? Oh, let's just try the one with the cute animals, Marge. Right this way, ma'am. This is a fine new Scandinavian film, one of our best. You got your heroine romping and cavorting with her horsey and her doggy, her frisky lambykins, and her fluffy chickie. Chickie? Ich. The manager hustles them quickly past occupied machines. Marge, that one sounds good. Swedish massage, rub-a-dub-dub. Oh, I hate it when they're dubbed. I'd rather see it in Swedish with subtitles. Well, here you are, ladies. See King Kong's girl tame wild horsey, doggy, and lambykins. Can you see, Mill? Maybe we should take turns. Shh, Marge, watch the picture. Look, here comes the chicken part. Oh, dear. She half covers her eyes like a child peeking at a scary movie. I don't think I understand her motivation. I wonder if the ASPCA reviews these. Actually, I think it's kind of cute. Look how it's eating out right out of her hand. Oh, Mill, that's disgusting. Imagine what Cleveland Amory would say. Suddenly, the picture clicks off, and the screen goes dark. Is that all? Where was the frisky lambykins? I didn't see any frisky lambykins. Maybe the horsey played two parts. No, I'm positive. There was no lambykins in the entire picture. Look. See, Marge, this is a clear case of consumer fraud. Listen, Millicent, I don't think they give refunds in here, even if not completely satisfied. Is that true? No refunds? Manager, nervously, no refunds. Even if not completely satisfied? Manager, satisfied? Nobody comes in here to get satisfied. What kind of place do you think this is, lady? Come on, Mill, I know when I'm not wanted. Well, I'm reporting this to the Department of Consumer Affairs. What is that, a French picture? As they leave, the male customers close ranks. The manager follows the women to the door, reaches outside for his adults-only sign, and slowly tears off the bottom half, which contained the message, women also welcome. At this, there is an audible sigh of relief from the men. Two of them wave their rumpled raincoats in triumph.
My name is Robin Morgan. When I was 6 years old, something happened which I have never told. I was made by a room full of adults to stand up at a party for adults and slowly take off all the clothing I had on, which was pinafores and socks and little patent leather Mary Jane shoes, and even my hair ribbon, down to my little ruffled underpants. While reading, because I was precocious and I could read at six, thereby making it more convenient, an obscene piece of writing. I cannot really remember the content, the mind being an effective block, if necessary, for certain kinds of survival, but I know it had something to do with one female, whether adult or child, I don't know, being gang-banged by a group of adult males. Now, the room full of adults were women as well as men. They included my aunt. They were theater people. They were well-meaning people. They thought they loved me. I was a kid actor. I was a member of their company. I grew up with them. This was a Christmas party. They were slightly drunk, and somebody thought it would be amusing, especially because it couldn't harm me, because I didn't know what I was reading. I did, of course. I must have realized about 10 seconds or less into the recital, particularly since the stage directions were written in, now take off your hair bow, now take off your pin. If somebody had written those in by hand, the writing itself, the piece itself was typed. I realized very early on, and I also must have realized in a split second that the way to survive that was to deny what I realized and most of all not let them know I knew, because surely that would be the ultimate humiliation. So the only other choice was to collaborate in their plans for me, which was that I was so innocent I ostensibly would collaborate because I didn't know what I was reading. It was a sealed universe. The logic was airtight. I grew up otherwise with your average warped American female childhood and adolescence. Fear, guilt, denial, body loathing. Hope, but mostly denial. A lot of humiliation. In the 60s, I came to political consciousness in the left, in the anti-war movement, and with a great many other women of my immediate generation and a little older and a little younger, I'm now 38, experienced enormous hope and then enormous brain-splitting disillusion at what we thought was a shared vision of a brave new world, becoming a brave new patriarchy. And one of the major means by which we were let to understand that was pornography in all of its various forms. Not only the obvious affirmation of pornography as so-called free speech via the Norman Mailer, Paul Krasner, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman et al. Cult, the male-defined, quote, free sexuality, being gang-banged yet again, this time correctly by the central committees of the left, but also, in a strange way, beginning to be affirmed, that whole pornographic sensibility, beginning to be affirmed blatantly for the violence that it always was. People maybe tend to forget that the reason that RAT, the underground newspaper, was the first underground newspaper seized by women in 1970, was because the women who had worked at RAT felt that it had become utterly pornographic. And those of us who had not worked at RAT felt the same, and we all came together and seized it. Around that time, I remember finding myself at a party in that vague overlap loft sensibility where the hippie and the left and the nascent feminism and all of these things came together and the sexual liberationists were about, and feeling myself tapped on the shoulder and turning around and seeing Al Goldstein, a notorious of Screw Magazine, standing there, and he punched me in the face. It's the only time in my life I've ever been struck by a man. It had a quality of utter unreality to it, and I pushed him through what turned out to be a wall. I mean, it wasn't a very big wall. It was like a plasterboard panel, but it, you know, twill do, twill serve. In 1970, there were a group of us who seized and occupied the executive offices at Grove Press over pornography, over the fact that although Grove claimed to be revolutionary and literary, and did indeed publish a few books which were revolutionary and literary, the bulk of its production was the Black Cat line, the Venus line, the Delta line, and which was violent pornography, taking advantage of the rulings that Grove had earlier on won for serious literary works by Beckett, by Lawrence, etc., which even so one can have some problems with. Nonetheless, we were arrested, nine of us, and with felony arrests for trespassing and breaking and entering and doing various naughty things. And while we were in jail, we were jailed, not surprisingly, with prostitutes, women who were jailed for accused of prostitution, and we had a lot of very good talks. One of the most consciousness-raising things, perhaps the most, was the fact that the sisters we were jailed with had a delighted response to our action. One of our premises was that pornography was propaganda, was that it was the theory, and that rape and enforced prostitution, etc., were the practice. And one of our demands was that the profits that Grove made on their pornographic literature, since it went to propagandize a society toward prostitution, should then all those profits be turned into a bail fund to raise money to stand bail for prostitutes who, as far as we were concerned, were political prisoners. They liked that a lot. They thought that was good thinking. They also made an immediate and organic connection, which we had painfully struggled our way through in lots of CR sessions, to the pornography as propaganda argument. Very good conversations emerged from that, and more strategy and activism with some of those women. And now it's almost 1980. I keep looking forward very much to the 80s because this country seems to have a tendency to be nostalgic for the decade previous, not immediately previous. I mean, in the 70s, we had to endure nostalgia for the God help us 50s. Now that gives me hope, though, because in the 80s, you know what that means. And I guess the most important thing to me personally about this conference and about the upcoming demonstration and about what feminist activists across this country and indeed the world, across class and age and race lines, across economic lines, because this is an incredibly outreach issue, what feminist activists have been doing around this issue and the inextricably interlaced ones of racism, of violence, of rape, of battery, of child abuse, of all of those things, of the institutions of marriage, the institutions of motherhood, the institutions of heterosexism, the ways in which we have made the connections and the ways in which we seem no longer at last afraid to deny our humiliation and our fear and our terror and our rage and indeed our own morality seem to me things that has happened in maybe the last 20 years. So I very much look forward to this conference, to the workshops, to the march, to the 80s, Because you damned well right it's about time.
Did you ever think that you lived in a cage? Did you ever think that you lived?
You've been listening to The Velvet Sledgehammer. Today, a discussion about women and pornography. Excerpts from the first East Coast Conference on Women and Pornography, which was held in September of 1979.